ARUP Institute for Learning presents Insight.
Education.
Leader.
Technology.
Experimental.
Quality.
Esoteric.
Informatics.
Clinical utility.
Patient care.
Research. Laboratory.
Excellence.
Join us as we delve into emerging topics presented by ARUP medical directors who are faculty in the Department of Pathology at the University of Utah School of Medicine.
Tonight, healthcare takes center stage.
The stakes are high.
Millions of Americans.
Let's begin with the problems in our current healthcare system.
Yeah, and who's in it?
But this question about healthcare sparks passionate debate.
In the last segment, Dr. Jackson and Dr. Schmidt discussed bringing business thinking to the laboratory industry. Today, they continue their discussion by exploring the topic of diagnostic studies.
Yeah, there's a journal that I don't read regularly, but I at least follow the table of contents, called Evidence-Based Medicine by the BMJ Group. And it strikes me that whenever I look at the table of contents, there's typically an average of 1 to 2 review articles on diagnostic issues, and the rest of it's on mostly therapeutics.
Well, that's very true. In any given year, there's about 12,000 randomized controlled trials in progress on therapeutics. And I think the average for diagnostics is 37. And the reason for that's a couple of things. One is there's just not the payoff that there is and the economic motivation there is for diagnostic tests versus therapeutics. And the other thing is diagnostic tests are much less efficient than therapeutic tests. Because really all that matters when you're comparing two different diagnostic modalities are the people that are cross-classified, that are what you look at what's called net reclassification of patients. And so you need much, much larger sample sizes than you do for a therapeutic trial. So it makes it even more expensive to do these trials versus for a therapeutic intervention for much less payoff. So there's no wonder that there's few. And kind of the way they typically happen is they're piggybacked on as a companion diagnostic, for example, for a therapeutic trial.
Now, you've done some work with the Cochrane Collaboration and doing some of the review work that goes into the Cochrane stuff.
Once again, I think there's a great deal more heterogeneity, and by that I mean variation in results for diagnostic tests than there are for therapeutics. So, for example, I've done a lot of work with fine needle aspiration. When you look at a diagram of the results people get, it just looks like a scatter plot, depending on who knows what the reasons are. You know, their location, the methodology they use, the skill of the personnel, and so on. And that's very difficult to sort out. And meta-analysis can be a huge help in that. Unfortunately, the techniques to do meta-analysis and diagnostic studies has only recently been developed, and I think in the early 2000s. And you've seen the meta-analyses that were done up until recently were done improperly. They take a great deal of work. And the Cochrane Collaboration, I think, is the highest standard of those kinds of studies. I've embarked on a couple of them. They typically take, you know, a year or two to do.
For one diagnostic test.
They're very, very rigorous in their approach. And one of the things that's very interesting about Cochrane that I like is that you contract with them to do one of these studies. And they just say, this is a question we're interested in. We would like to know the answer. And it doesn't matter whether you have a positive result or a negative result. We just want to know. And so you basically write down a protocol of what you'll do. And the chips fall where they will. And if you execute that protocol, they will publish it. And what that prevents is a lot of the subgroup analysis and sort of thing that goes on that, you know, anyone that's worked on publishing a paper goes, you know, we've ended up with a negative result. Now what? You know, did it work for left-handed people on Wednesdays? Maybe we can publish that. You know, so the Cochrane approach really removes that. And that's been done for a long time in the clinical trial world where they have clinical trial registries. And people basically register a protocol for the study, and that's what the study question is. Something else, if they find something, it is a hypothesis and may be the subject of another study, but it's an incidental finding.
So you're pointing out all of the challenges in that example that to do a Cochrane level of rigor can take a couple of years worth of work for one individual diagnostic test. So given that we have so many tests out there, should we just sort of throw up our hands in frustration and say, well, you know, it's not realistic to do evidence-based diagnostics?
No, I mean, I think the Cochrane-type rigor definitely has a place. And I mean, we've seen good examples of that in therapeutics as well, where, say, for hormone replacement therapy, where people were looking at observational studies and came to the wrong conclusion, and it was only through rigorous studies that people actually found out that HRT was actually harmful. And I think the same sort of thing can happen, and we should be doing as rigorous studies as we can. But on the other hand, tests are being developed at such a high rate, there's a need to do quick and dirty kinds of analyses that are probably mostly right, and that we can look at the efficacy of tests. The other thing about sort of a Cochrane review is these are based on diagnostic accuracy studies. It has nothing to do with, again, with patient outcomes. It's a necessary but not sufficient condition to, you know, look at the actual utility of a test. So a test does need to have good performance in terms of its sensitivity and specificity, its diagnostic accuracy, but that in itself is not enough to make a test have high utility. So we can do things such as like what we do here at ARUP of looking at sort of other indices, looking at just benchmarking across spectrums of clients, for example. Can we find outliers? You know, for example, sometimes we'll find one hospital that's 10% of our overall business that's ordering 90% of one test. And sometimes there's a good reason for that. They're a specialized hospital, and that's completely appropriate. In other cases, it represents misutilization, and we can find things. It's not through any rigorous kind of process. It's more hypothesis generating. But oftentimes when people dig into that, they'll find that it is indeed misutilization, and that didn't require years of study to do. That can be pretty quick. The other kinds of things is that where there are guidelines available, we can look at variation from those guidelines. For example, for thyroid testing or screening for pheochromocytoma, vitamin D, various things like that, we have a pretty good idea of what appropriate testing is, and gross deviations from that can be identified pretty easily from ordering patterns. The problem is most tests don't fall into that category. You have many, many tests, you know, for example, probably the biggest ones in a hospital in terms of cost will be CBCs, basic metabolic profile, and so forth. And it's very hard to tell when and where that's proper utilization and misutilization.
The point that I heard you making to lead into that topic was that just because a test is accurate doesn't mean that it should be used, or maybe that's not the right way to phrase it.
No, I think that's pretty close. There's a hierarchy of evidence that Rita Horvath and her colleagues just recently published in ClinChem Acta, in which they gave this sort of pyramid where each lower level is necessary but not sufficient for the next level of utility. So at the very bottom level, there's laboratory performance. You know, does the test give a result that's reproducible and accurate and so forth? And we do a very good job at that. Most labs do. And there's good evidence for that. At the next level is clinical effectiveness. So does that measurement help us classify patients of having disease or not having disease? And so that's the next level. So just because you can measure something accurately doesn't mean it can help you classify patients, you know, if you measure some analyte. So at the next level is this clinical effectiveness. Then at the next level is, after we classify patients with a clinical performance level, is there clinical utility? Does that enable us to change therapy and improve outcomes for some patients? So even though you can diagnose patients accurately, it doesn't do any good unless you can have some therapy that can help them, or you reclassify them in a way that can help them. And then finally, at another level on top of that, would be cost-effectiveness analysis. And just because you can help people doesn't mean you should use the drug. What if the drug cost $1 billion? You could probably do, you know, millions of vaccinations or some other intervention for that price. So cost-effectiveness is the next level that needs to be considered. And then finally, there's just societal concerns, which are fairly diffuse. But they have a very nice hierarchy of a way of looking at tests one upon the other. And at each level is necessary but not sufficient for, I think, effectiveness at the level above it.
It really does sound like a useful hierarchy, because it seems like in the simplified world that we live in, that it's just assumed if a test can classify patients accurately, then it must be an important test to run.
Yeah, that's not necessarily true.
Can you just illustrate with an example? So imagine you have a test that's 100% accurate at classifying a patient with disease.
There's certain controversy about tests of this sort, say like genetic tests that can classify you as having a disease for which there's no treatment. Maybe some value in that, but let's say I can go out and have a test that tells me whether I'll develop Alzheimer's disease in the next 20 years. I might live my life differently if I had that knowledge, perhaps. And there may be some value in that, but there's going to be no treatment, you know, that can help me.
Yeah. Does redundancy play into this? Ordering, you know, two or three tests when you already had the answer?
This is an area that I think is very difficult to evaluate. So most of the time, we're at a primitive level, we look at a single test and try and evaluate its utility. But really what happens in the context of medicine is there's, as you say, many different tests. And so how do you evaluate the incremental contribution of one test on top of another? Very hard to do. The usual sort of thing you see in textbooks is based on likelihood ratios, which assume that the tests are independent. But that's often not the case, that there's some underlying mechanism that's common to both tests, and so they overlap a lot, and they don't add completely independent and new information. And I think that's a growing area of research that statisticians are working on, and how to evaluate the incremental value of a new biomarker, for example.
On the next segment.
So at multiple different levels now, you know, diagnostic accuracy, clinical impact, cost effectiveness, at all of these different levels, you're identifying these are really fundamentally hard things to do, hard to generate the evidence base. And what are your thoughts here? Is there light at the end of this tunnel?